WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. As you know by now, this is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. And this is our eighth and final episode of Season 1. Today, Doug McCabe and I are going to read your emails, comments, and questions about the stories you heard this season, and we're going to talk about the stories you submitted for consideration for the second season of our podcast, which include a few in Athens, but also start to branch out to other cemeteries with numbered tombstones in Ohio and one in West Virginia. Doug, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks.
Well, first, before we get into the listener comments and questions, tell me what kinds of things you've heard about the podcast and the stories that we've been able to tell this season.
Well, I've heard from my granddaughter, for example, who, interestingly enough, because she's only 24 years old, and maybe it's just because she knows her papa is a part of this thing that she's been listening in. And that's wonderful. It's neat to know that there are lots of people out there who are just as interested in this topic as we are.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. And I think it's one of those things that almost anybody can relate to, which is what, you know, because these stories are so normal things that happen to people. And so you wouldn't think that those kind of people would have been institutionalized. I think it's just... It's so relatable, I guess is the word. Would you agree with that?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. It's an interesting look too at the evolution of treatments for people who are allegedly mentally challenged, or, you know, in the old term, insane or lunatics. And whether things have changed all that much or changed a great deal.
Well, we received many emails and comments on our social media pages from people across the country who are listening to the podcast. One was even from a descendant of one of the people we featured. So let's start with that email. It was from Suzette Kern, who is the great-great-granddaughter of Adam Kern, the Civil War veteran we featured in Episode 3. Suzette wrote, "I just listened to your podcast on Adam Kern. Adam Kern was my great-great-grandfather. Your podcast brought back so many memories of our visits to the Athens Asylum, meeting with Doug McCabe and others about the numbered gravestone. My brother David passed away in 2014, and hearing his voice during the interview was so special. I remember standing next to him as he was being interviewed. What you've done with this podcast is so very special. I'm full of gratitude. Thank you for keeping the memory of Adam Kern alive." We responded to that email and arranged a phone call with Suzette to talk about the impact putting a named marker on Adam's gravesite had on her family. Here's that conversation. We're talking now with Suzette Kern. She is one of Adam Kern's descendants, and Adam Kern was featured in Episode 3 of our podcast. Suzette, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So you sent a really beautiful email to us after Adam's episode aired on the podcast. Can you just talk a little bit about how hearing his story on the podcast affected you?
Oh, sure. You know, it was so special because, first of all, there was the Adam Kern story that just touched all of our hearts and in our family. But as I mentioned to you as well, my brother David, who was featured on that podcast giving his interview, he passed away 8 years ago. So to hear his voice again speaking of Adam Kern, and I remember being with him when he was being interviewed by you, I believe, when we were at that ceremony. I was standing next to him, so that was really special. But I was just so grateful that Adam Kern, you know, his life lived on with that podcast and having the actor's voice, you know, it was just very, very special.
So you mentioned, yes, that was me, by the way that interviewed you and you and David. You mentioned that David passed away 8 years ago. And when I read that, I thought, I'm so glad that he was, you know, that he was able to be a part of locating Adam, because it really seemed to be so important to him. Why do you think that was so important to him?
Well, you know, so Actually, my younger brother Ken had started the genealogy research in our family many, many, many years ago, and then much later in our family we took up the genealogical search again. But because of what Ken had done many years ago, we knew the name Adam Kern, but you know he never was more than just kind of a, you know, a box in that family tree. Didn't know anything about him other than just his name. So when my brother David found out about Adam Kern being buried in the asylum cemetery, you know, back then, as you mentioned, it was the Athens Lunatic Asylum. And he called me. So, I mean, we were all just kind of shocked. And we went there for Memorial Day. And I believe that in 2010. And I think that's when they were doing some kind of service for Viola Rapp. And back then, you know, we were not prepared for the emotions that would come over us when we stood at Adam Kern's gravesite, you know, just to see 251 there. And there was just no dignity and no respect for him as ever having kind of walked this earth. And we kind of made this promise that we would make that right. And we would try to get a proper gravestone for him. And so that kind of started a family journey for us, which led to the, you know, visits to the National Archives and, you know, working with the Veterans Administration, filling out the paperwork, which, trust me, if you haven't dealt with a Veterans Administration paperwork for getting a gravestone, you're in for quite an experience because, you know, Adam Kern was a Civil War vet, and the VA applications, you know, they require specific forms, some of them that obviously didn't exist during the Civil War, but all of that was done. So when we came back for that veterans ceremony, and I believe that's when I met you and you did the interviews, it was really kind of this circle that the family had completed. It was our promise that we would make this right. And it was just very, very special for David and my cousin Marianne Goss, who was there and, you know, was with us every step of this journey. So I don't even know if I answered your question, but it was just such an emotional thing that happened to this family to find his gravestone and make it right.
Well, Suzette, you mentioned Viola Rapp, and we have talked to her great-granddaughter, you know, since we started working on this podcast. And she shared that putting this marker and finding this grave of their relative really was like this weight lifted off that they didn't even know they were carrying. Do you feel the same way with what when you guys went through with Adam Kern?
Oh, what a beautiful way to put it. That's exactly right. Because, you know, until you stand there and look at a gravestone of somebody whose blood is in you, it's just a number. You don't know that weight. But yeah, I like that. That's a beautiful way to put it.
So, what did you guys do any more family genealogy after Adam Kern? Have there been any new discoveries?
No, not too much. And not to get into a really long side story, we started up the second serious genealogical research when both of my brothers found out that we have a hereditary disease in the family that takes family members at a very young age. And so that kind of started the search to go back into all of the family records to find out, you know, the cause of death for different folks, because we were part of a genetic research study being done for that disease out of UT Southwestern. So that was kind of the genesis of the rebirth of the great genealogical search. Unfortunately, both of my brothers who had that illness has passed away. And the research that was done based on our family was really helpful. They found the genetic marker in the DNA sequence. And so there's a test for it now. So that kind of ended that kind of journey for us. But gosh, now we have, you know, we have Adam Kern's gravesite there. And, you know, what else came from this was like, I never really knew my cousin, Marianne Goss, in Logan, Ohio. And oh my gosh, we've all fallen in love with each other. So that just kind of started up another whole family tree that has just become so strong. And yeah, it's all been good, but we have not continued with any kind of genealogical studies anymore. At least I haven't. My younger brother, Ken, continues to. He's very good at that.
You bring up another point, which I actually have discovered in my own life as well, that doing this genealogical research and finding these people and finding out about them can help you be proactive about health situations that you might face. So in that situation where you guys were looking into this disease and this hereditary disease, did any of that link back to Adam Kern? Were you able to find anything out about him?
No, I think it was just too far back. And of course, you know, the disease that our family carries the marker for, it's a lung disease. There's a name for it now. There wasn't a name for it a couple of generations back. So, you know, when you start looking at the family records or the death certificates, it's all kind of things like, you know, lung disease or something very vague. So it was pretty hard to make the linkage once you got back a generation or two.
Remind me, what age was Adam when he passed away? Do you remember?
I believe it was 61.
Okay. So he was relatively young as well. So, wow, that's really interesting to that you guys found that and did so much work. Is there anything else that you would like to say about the podcast and kind of his story being brought up again a decade later and all the other stories that we're telling with it?
Oh, you know, I just have to say what I said to you earlier. I mean, it's such a gift for you all to do that and for the family members. For others listening in, it's kind of like, oh, this is a really interesting podcast. But for the family members, you know, the descendants, it's now we have something recorded and you know, we have this actor's voice. I mean, it's just a real gift and I really do thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you so much, Suzette, for joining us and for sending your email and for connecting with us again.
Thank you.
Doug, this conversation with Suzette brings up a very interesting point. I think not only does connecting the names to these grave markers allow families to know where their ancestors are located and learn about them, in some cases, the person buried under the number could connect present-day descendants to important genetic information, which could help them make preventative decisions that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to. So that's an interesting thing that I hadn't thought about.
Well, right. But I do have to say, I wish I could be more helpful when it comes to genetic medical information. But I have found little to no information regarding that in the records of the asylum. The committal papers reveal only minimal reasons for insanity, and the grave book might give cause of death, and death records that might be at the health department are really pretty much the same. So, and then also any asylum medical assessments of patients seem to no longer exist.
Oh, wow. So we have no idea where those have ended up.
Correct.
Okay. Well, we also received many other emails and comments via social media and podcast reviews. Stephen from New Orleans, Louisiana wrote in and said, I love that Sherry, Doug, and all are helping to give names to the numbered markers at the old asylum's three cemeteries. It had me think about my own life. Had I lived and died back then, would I have just been a number? Locked away in an asylum due to my various diagnoses, medical conditions, lifestyle. Buried in an unmarked grave with just a number, like it's a GPS location, rather than a human being who had lived a life. Whether it was great or not, made a difference in the world or not. Further, it makes me think, once I'm deceased, who will come to my grave and who will remember me and how? It definitely hurts my heart that so many of these people had a life that wasn't deemed worthy enough to even have their name on their headstone, yet warms my heart to know that others like Sherry and her friends are giving them what they should have had in the first place. Doug, I think the stories we're telling are making a lot of people think about things that they've gone through in their own lives, like, you know, me with my postpartum and realizing that if they were born in a different time, they could have been one of these people, which is one of the things I think makes telling these stories so important.
Oh, I think so as well. It really does come down to recognizing the humanity of humans.
Yep, recognizing that all people are people, no matter what their situation, right?
Right.
Well, here are some other messages we received. Doug in Lancaster, Ohio wrote, "I wanted to drop a quick line and tell you how much I'm enjoying your series, Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I know that it takes a lot of time and research, but please keep them coming. Everyone's life is a story to tell, and you and your team are doing a great job telling theirs." Monica in Columbus, Ohio wrote, "The only things I heard about the asylum near Ohio University revolved around ghost stories, and it turns out much greater horrors occurred. Yet this new series blends journalism, narrative, and investigative work into episodes that tell the lives of real people, which is compelling and noble. Awesome work. Can't wait to listen to future seasons." Sally from Logan, Ohio wrote, "While I've known that women were institutionalized for such things as PMS and postpartum depression, it's still hard to fathom what they lived through. Thank you. I'm enjoying the podcast so far." And Sheila in Cincinnati, Ohio wrote in, "Thank you for honoring these lives. Great job and fascinating piece of history." Doug, we also got some interesting comments, questions, and information from listeners. Both Claudia S. and Faith K. wrote in to comment on the discussion that you and I had about how those in the asylum cemeteries were buried. We talked about how it's believed, we don't know, but it's believed they were buried 4 feet deep and they were not embalmed. And Claudia S. wrote, "Not choosing to embalm a deceased person and instead shrouding them in biodegradable material such as cotton or silk is a choice that many people are now making. Athens has a green burial group that is educating people on how to ensure that your own death does not add to the pollution of our planet. It may have been a practice used because at the time it was cheap, but many of us are making those choices now for other reasons. Burying someone only 4 feet ensures that their body can be restored to the earth in a biodegradable and earth-friendly way." Doug, that's certainly a perspective I hadn't thought about, and Claudia makes a great point from a present-day perspective, but things have changed over time in regards to what constitutes a proper burial. And at the time these people were buried, that wouldn't have been considered a respectful burial, correct?
Pretty much. Burials and caskets have been popular for a long period of time prior to the Civil War. For those who could afford it, embalming became popular during the war, especially of soldiers who died from far away from their home. Grave markers, headstones, and the like have been around for hundreds and thousands of years and have contained names, dates, and even short messages and illustrations. That said, unembalmed and shrouded burials were also quite common, and a wide range of institutions used numbered headstones and probably relied on grave books to identify individual burials. Interestingly, when I was at the Soldier Cemetery at Vicksburg last year, I saw that nearly all the graves had markers labeled unknown. I doubt people back then thought their style of burial was earth-friendly, but I must say that the current trend is really pretty commendable.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, along similar lines, Pam C. wrote in to ask if there are any organizations who are actively taking care of the asylum cemeteries. I know that the Athens chapter of the National Alliance for Mental Illness is involved in taking care of the cemeteries in Athens. Are there any other organizations that you know that are working on that, Doug?
Not that I'm aware of. And when it comes to caretaking of the Athens Asylum Cemeteries, I can say that when the state of Ohio transferred ownership of the asylum to Ohio University in 1988, the Department of Mental Health retained ownership of the cemeteries and then for years did nothing to take care of them. Only when Tom Walker and others of the Athens chapter of NAMI complained about the conditions did the department provide them with a small amount of funds so they could clear brush and saplings, fill in dimples. This is like the
divots
beginning to collapse of graves.
Yeah.
And repair and reset markers. Plus, they convinced the university to now mow the grounds at least twice a year. So caretaking has been handled by volunteerism.
Wow. Okay. Well, Neil wrote in and said, I just listened to your podcast yesterday and very well done. It took me back to my visits with my grandparents who lived in Apple Creek, Ohio, and worked at a similar hospital as the one in Athens. I wonder if there is a similar cemetery at all of those facilities around the state. Keep up your great work and investigations. Doug, we know that there are many institutions in Ohio and around the country that use the numbered tombstone approach, but we still don't know for sure why this approach was chosen, correct?
Yeah, I can only speculate that numbered markers were purely an economical decision with a grave book or ledger as a backup.
Okay. And Doug, you got an interesting email from John C. about episode 5, where we told the story of Robert Barlow, who was not buried at the asylum, and the asylum gravebook indicates his body was given to Ohio University. Doug, what did you learn from John?
Well, according to John, and this is something I need to dig into, I guess, although it would be a massive undertaking, in that there were several places in Columbus that would take unclaimed bodies to use for dissections and so forth. And there is that possibility then that there were bodies from the Athens asylum that were sent up to Columbus. I mean, I know I've documented that there were bodies given to Ohio University for the same purpose, and I don't know what ended up happening with those bodies. And of course, I don't know what happened in Columbus either, for that matter.
One of the things we want to do on this podcast is start to explore the stories of people buried at institutions outside of Athens under numbered tombstones. And we had a couple of people write in to make suggestions about other cemeteries we could explore. Joining us now is Paul LaRue. Paul shared his expertise during season 1 of our podcast, as he's a retired social studies teacher and is on the State Board of Education in Ohio. He's also conducted research projects involving veterans and unmarked graves. After listening to the first few episodes of season 1 of our podcast, Paul sent me an email asking if we could explore stories from those buried under numbered tombstones at the old Feeble-Minded Institute in Orion, Ohio. Paul, tell us what you know about this institution and the burials there.
Well, thanks, Sherry. It's a fascinating story. The state of Ohio opened its original Feeble-Minded Institute in downtown Columbus in 1857. It was at a time, actually, when there was great interest in asylums just like the one in Athens. In fact, the 1840 U.S. Census asked for the number of insane, the number of blind, the number of deaf, and the number of feeble-minded. So, you know, 180 years ago, this was something that there was great interest in. So Columbus had, you know, the Feeble-Minded Institute in 1857, but it burned in 1881. So in 1899, the state of Ohio purchased 1,800 acres of farmland in northern Pickaway County near the village of Orient. The land included the Foster Cemetery, which was a small country cemetery. And then from 1900 to 1972, the state operated the Feeble-Minded Institute Farm there at Orient. During that time, more than 800 residents died and are buried in the cemetery under very similar headstones, bearing only a number.
Wow. So I guess my follow-up question for you, Paul, is what made you feeble-minded? What was the criteria for that?
Great question. And in fact, feeble-minded, even though it's an archaic term, is frankly kinder. In fact, in the 1840 census, they used the term idiot. So, you know, you see the terms idiot and imbeciles and some very, you know, very uncomfortable terms to listen to today, but it was someone of lower IQ.
Wow. So feeble-minded was the politically correct version, huh?
Yes. And it, like I said, it still sounds, and as though it, like I said, it's a clunky term, but it certainly is preferable to some of the other terms.
Wow. Okay. So Doug, it seems like this institute and the Athens Asylum used a very similar approach. If you weren't claimed by your family, you were buried on the grounds under a number, which is, you know, what we've heard from lots of different places, right?
Oh yeah. My understanding is you can find the same kind of thing in Columbus for prisoners from the penitentiary who died there and were unclaimed. And I know, for example, the Toledo Asylum used numbered graves. And I think it's fair to assume that most other institutions throughout not only Ohio, but throughout the country did very much the same thing.
Wow. So, Paul, how did you get involved with learning about this facility? And what do we know about the stories of the people who were buried there?
Well, it's interesting. Washington Courthouse, we are equidistant to about six correctional facilities, two in London, two in Chillicothe, one in Lebanon and Orient. And over the years, lots of folks in our community work at those institutions. And I was doing a parent-teacher conference a number of years ago, and one of my former students who was there for a parent-teacher conference was a corrections officer at Orient. And he knew that we were doing work in the cemeteries at that time. And he said, hey, you know what? You would be fascinated with a cemetery on the grounds of what is now, or, you know, Pickaway Correctional Institute.
Was there an age range of people who were at the Feeble-Minded Institute? Because some things that I found online seem to indicate that there were children who were housed there.
You could go there, and I know more about the cemetery than about this, but my understanding is somewhat like yours. You could go there as a child, but you could be there for many, many years.
Okay. So it wasn't only children who were housed at this facility?
No.
Okay. So I guess my last question, and you've kind of answered this already, but what makes you so interested in exploring this facility further and working with us on having some of the stories featured in the podcast?
Well, it's a fascinating, I mean, every cemetery is fascinating, but it's fascinating to me that this, you know, on the grounds of this cemetery, there's really three. There's a early country cemetery. There's the Feeble-Minded Institute Cemetery, and there's it's still an actively used cemetery. There's a prisoner section today, which kind of goes back to what Doug was saying, for the Pickaway Correctional. So it is still a cemetery that is an actively used cemetery.
Well, we look forward to exploring the stories there for next season. We also got a note from Maggie in Moundsville, West Virginia, asking us to explore the former Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which was later called the Weston State Hospital, which is located in Weston, West Virginia. Maggie said there are three cemeteries on that site and then went on to say, quote, sadly, the few markers that were there were ripped up by vandals. The state put up a large stone in memory of all the patients who were buried there, but there are no individual markers or stones for the patients. So it's unclear if there were numbered tombstones at one point, but the result's the same. These people are buried without their names or dates on a tombstone. Doug or Paul, do either of you know anything about these cemeteries? Doug, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm afraid I don't know about the Weston State Hospital, but I can only encourage people who are interested, particularly local West Virginians, to perhaps dig into the history and try to find out the names and dates of those patients buried there.
Paul, have you ever heard anything about this facility in West Virginia?
I have not, but similar to what Doug said, I think it's what's interesting is, again, when communities get interested in those things, and that's, again, back to the Feeble-Minded, we partnered with the prison and they actually shared their records with us to make this possible. So it's really when those kind of community partnerships, that's what makes these rich stories come out.
Well, Maggie gave us some really good leads on how to get started, some community partnerships, some people to reach out to and telling a few of the stories from there. So we're going to look into that and we look forward to exploring the stories of both of these hospitals, cemeteries next season. Paul LaRue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you, guys.
But there are also still many stories from Athens to explore. Several of you wrote in sharing information you had on your relatives who are believed to be buried in the asylum cemeteries, and we're hoping to explore some of those stories for season two. Before we get into those, there was one person who wrote in, Doug, to tell us about his great-grandmother who lived at the Athens Asylum in the mid-1930s. who is a story we wouldn't normally tell on this podcast because she's not buried in the asylum cemeteries, but I share it because it speaks to other tragic outcomes at the asylum that didn't end with being buried under a numbered tombstone. Nick sent in this email. Hello, I love the podcast and the stories you are uncovering with it. I've been listening a lot. I write because my great-grandmother was a patient at the asylum in the 1930s. From my guess, she may have been there with postpartum, but I'm still doing my own research and getting with Ohio University or getting access to records. However, what makes my great-grandmother's story stick out is the fact that she was actually murdered at the asylum almost a year to the day she was committed. I am sure she would make an amazing story. She's supposedly buried in Nelsonville in Greenlawn, I believe, but I have not found a gravestone. Nick attached two newspaper articles which outline how his great-grandmother Sheila Rudder was strangled to death with a bedsheet by another female inmate when she was just 33 years old. Doug, do you know anything about this story?
Well, I did a little looking myself, and I found that she was admitted in 1935 to the asylum as patient number 7898 from Athens County. Unfortunately, the committal papers are missing from the Ohio University archives, but copies could still be in the probate court lunacy files of Athens County. And, of course, her death certificate would be at the county health department.
Okay. Well, from your research, was murder an unusual occurrence at the asylum?
Murders at the asylum were unusual, but they did happen. An example would be Eliza Gerhardt, who was admitted in 1880 and was beaten to death by patients that same year. She was accused of theft. Another patient was beaten to death with a hammer in the tin shop, and another patient wandered off and was run over by a train.
Oh, wow.
And then finally still another patient, while on an outing on the grounds, drowned himself in one of the lakes. Then there's the woman whose stain is on the floor, who was allegedly choked to death by a staff member.
Wow. And this takes me back to something that you said a long time ago when we were talking about the asylum. You said it was like its own little city. And so things that happened in a city or a town happened in this smaller community at the asylum.
Exactly. All you have to do is think of Athens, Ohio, or Ohio University and what goes on there, and you're going to find very similar things in quite possibly the same percentages up at the asylum.
Well, now on to stories we plan to explore of those buried under numbered tombstones at the asylum for season two. Tracy Rylands from Georgia reached out, and she has two relatives buried under numbered tombstones in Athens. Let's listen to her voicemail.
Hi, Sherry. My name is Tracy Rylands, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I saw that you're about to do a podcast on the inmates of the Athens Asylum. And I wanted to reach out because I actually have two relatives that were in the asylum in the 1870s and the 1880s. And one was Levi Mercer, whose grave number 153, he's buried in the cemetery in the Ridges. And I just found out last night that his daughter, Amanda Smith, is buried there as well. I didn't even know that she existed until last night. She's in grave number 13. They're both in cemetery number 1. But I wanted to reach out in case you might want to talk to me about that, because Levi had quite an interesting story. I don't know how much time he spent in Athens, but I do know he died there and is buried there. He died in 1888 and is in the directory. Amanda died there in 1881 and had only been there, I think, for about 6 years. But Levi is my great-great-great-great-great-granduncle, if you can believe it.
Well, Doug, what do we know at this point about Levi Mercer and Amanda Smith?
Well, Levi was admitted in 1888 as patient number 2048 from Jackson County, Ohio. Unfortunately, his admission records are missing at the Ohio University Archives, but might be found in the Jackson County Probate Court. He shows up in census records all the way back to 1820. And he had been a farmer and appears to always have lived in Jackson County in his mature years, but he was a native of Virginia. By 1860, he was a patient in the Columbus Asylum. So he would have been transferred from Columbus Asylum to the Athens Asylum after its opening in 1874. And he's buried in the asylum in grave number 153 at cemetery number 1. And he was buried on November 8th, 1888.
Wow. So what about Amanda?
She was admitted on September 13th, 1874, as patient number 330 from Jackson County, at the age of 45, and at that time she was a resident of Hamilton Township in that county. Again, there's census records that show her, at least from 1850, she was married and had several children. And then finally, by the 1880 census, she's shown as 51 years old and living in the asylum. And in her case, she was buried April 5th, 1881, in grave number 13 at cemetery number 1.
Well, I think it's interesting that these two relatives are both at the asylum. I don't know what that means, but I guess we'll dig into it a little bit more for season 2.
Well, and I think we'll find, as I have found, there are a number of instances of family members being in the asylum. Like Eliza Gerhardt, I mentioned earlier, her sister was in the asylum as well.
So interesting. Doug, you've also been working with a woman named Danielle and gathering information about her great-great-grandmother, Jane Johnson, who's buried under number 345. Tell us what you've learned about Jane so far.
Well, the interesting thing there was Daniel wrote to me and noted that I had the wrong person in that grave. And she sent me some record information that she had found, including an obituary. And so then I went and did some looking on my own and found that, yes, I was wrong and she was right. And so I've fixed my database to include that. And then it also turned out that she and her parents came to see the grave, which, by the way, is numbered. And I met them at the asylum and went over to the cemetery, and we found the grave. And I'm hoping that next season we can talk in some more depth and detail with her.
Well, Tamara Evans sent in this email. I really don't know much about my distant relative, Henry Goodwin. Date of birth, 1830. Date of death, January 11th, 1890. Cause of death is TB. Henry was admitted to the asylum in 1874, son of Nathan and Diantha Goodwin. I found out Henry was buried and lived at the Athens Asylum from another genealogy friend who shared with me a list of people buried there. The Goodwin family lived in Tioga, hopefully I'm saying that right, County, Pennsylvania, when Henry was born, then moved to Hocking County, Ohio. Henry was a brother to my great-grandfather, Solomon B. Goodwin. Six brothers from this large family served in the Civil War, but not Henry, as he wouldn't have been of age to serve. His marker is number 174, and a stone with his name and dates was placed there in a 2013 ceremony. Doug, do we know anything about Henry at this point?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I can give a little bit more detail. He was admitted in 1874, which is the year the asylum was opened, as patient number 90 from Hocking County. And yes, he was a native of Pennsylvania and had been a laborer. And he did die in 1890, and he's buried in grave number 174 at cemetery number 1.
Okay. Well, Joyce sent us a note that said, I just listened to the podcast about the asylum. I know of someone who was buried there in 1964. His name was Dustin Wilson. He was married to the woman who took my mother in as an orphan during the Depression. I'm curious if there's any information about him. I believe he was born around 1900. I know a few stories about him, but don't know if any of it is factual. The story I always heard was that he was a police officer who was shot in the head. His injury was inoperable and damaged his brain. That's quite a story, Doug. Have you heard anything about Dustin Wilson?
Well, I did some looking, and in the database that I put together for the cemeteries, I do not see a Dustin Wilson buried at the asylum. Now, the admissions index that is at the Ohio University Archives does not show him admitted in 1954 or before. So he could have been admitted later than that, and I just don't have any access to that. And I also don't know where he might be buried. It's possible that he could have been released from the asylum and buried in a local cemetery.
All right. Daniel sent an email about his great-great-aunt. Her name was Prudence P. Parkinson Kincaid. She was born in 1840 and died in 1908. She's buried under grave number 282, and her parents were Richard Parkinson and Mary E. Templeton. Do you know much about Prudence at this point?
Well, a little bit. She was admitted on September 23rd, 1904, as patient number 4065 from Muskingum County at the age of 63. And she had been a resident of Falls Township in that county. And she was a native of Ohio, a housewife, widowed, fair education, unknown religion, and had been at the Columbus Asylum at the age of 36. She had had two children, with the youngest at the time of admittance. The youngest child was 27.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully there's more to explore there. It sounds like it. And finally, David sent a note asking about his relative, Francis Mitten, who is buried under number 983. David said, I have a keen interest in this as I have a relative buried there, a female with the last name of Mitten. There are no living relatives that know her story, and I'm curious about how she came to end up in Athens. Doug, did you find anything on Francis?
I did.
Ooh, okay. You say that with much curiosity.
Well, to start with, Francis Mitten was a male.
Oh,
not a female.
Wow. Okay.
And was first admitted in 1892 as patient number 2667 from Ross County. And then he was readmitted on June 7th, 1900 as patient number 3738, also from Ross County. At the age of 31, he'd been a resident of Scioto Township, a native of Ohio, and transferred from jail with no occupation, single, ordinary education, and a Protestant.
Huh. So there's a prison story behind that one.
Yes, and he's not the only one I've come across who had been in prison or transferred from prison. As you might remember from an early broadcast, Levi Stevens had also been transferred from a county jail.
Yes, Eli Stevens had been. So much to explore for season two, Doug. Thank you for all your work that have made telling these stories possible. Before we go, quickly, you know, what has this first season of the podcast meant to you?
Well, this has been a thrilling combination, a continuation, really, of a quarter century of my interest in and work on the Athens Asylum and its cemeteries. But better yet, it's wonderful to find so many people, including my own granddaughter I mentioned earlier, show such interest and want to know more.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing that I've realized over this is that the research on things like this is never really finished. I mean, because somebody could find another piece of the puzzle that puts things casts a different light on something, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's important too, I think, to take into consideration not only records and a lot of these could be official records, But just even digging into newspapers and so forth, like, you know, I mentioned earlier, the obituary that convinced me that I had the wrong person in the wrong grave, but also family lore and how that can either fit in and fill in or get corrected in some cases too.
Well, it has meant so much to me as well to do this, even though we didn't know these people when they were alive. I feel like through meeting some of their relatives and putting a voice actor to their stories, we've now gotten a chance to know them a little bit. And I know there are many who are listening who've experienced some of the mental issues and traumas that these people have faced. So they empathize, just like, you know, my initial need to tell Viola Rapp's story, because I suffered from postpartum depression as well. So I think we can all relate on some level. And that's why it's so important to give these people in Athens a voice, but also explore outside of Athens and see if we can do that. So now it's time to get ready to work on season 2. Doug, you ready to jump in?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you for listening. And until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer, artwork by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe and Paul LaRue for contributing their knowledge and voices to this podcast. We want to continue to hear from you while we're producing season 2. So if you have questions, comments, or a tidbit of information that could help us, email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Also, if you like the show, please rate and subscribe, and also share it on social media and let others know about it, or visit woub.org to learn more.